KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. The nation knows Deb Haaland as a trailblazing Interior Secretary who championed a healing path for a dark time in the country's history. New Mexico knows her as a longtime leader in politics and tribal business. She's hoping to turn those local connections into her next political chapter. We'll hear from Haaland this hour, but we'll first hear about the fallout from a historic agreement over salmon conservation in the Northwest that was just dismantled by President Trump. That's all right after the news.
National Native News, I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Despite the U.S. Supreme Court refusing to hear arguments last month from Apache Stronghold, the nonprofit is trying to revive its religious freedom case over Oak Flat in Arizona. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrasio reports, the group's asking the High Court to reconsider.
I bet you the courts don't change their mind in 0.001% of the time.
Bob Miller's Eastern Shawnee and with ASU's Indian Legal Clinic. He's been following the saga to protect Oak Flat from copper mining. The nation's high court allows parties to reappeal a denied petition within 25 days. But Miller says asking the nine justices to reconsider will almost certainly not alter the outcome.
I cannot conceive of the Supreme Court changing its mind.
Conservative Justices Neil Gorsuch and Clarence Thomas argued in a dissent that not hearing Apache Stronghold's case was a grievous mistake, threatening to reverberate for generations. In a statement, Resolution Copper says the company appreciates the court's attention to this case, which had been reviewed over a dozen times. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrasio.
Although Alaska is the land of 100,000 glaciers, only 700 of them have names. Very few of those are indigenous, but it's important for the writer of the new book called The Alaska Glacier Dictionary to include them. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, it's more than a reference book, but full of stories.
Naomi Clouda says her Glacier Dictionary is for travelers and armchair adventurers alike, to give them quick access to a glacier's vital stats and nuggets of history, some that have been erased from recent memory.
There are some really beautiful Alaska Native designations on glaciers. They'll be very descriptive. So it was really important to me to go ahead and get the indigenous names wherever I could find them.
Like Kidazkuni, the Dena'ina name for a glacier on Mount Spur.
And it means one that is burning inside. Now, picture this glacier is on Mount Spur. So in local memory, in indigenous memory, they would have known about the times that Mount Spur had erupted.
Clouda says the names of Alaska glaciers also tell the story of colonialism. When geologists from the U.S. Geological Survey mapped and named glaciers, they often supplanted indigenous names or failed to acknowledge the contributions of Alaska Natives, like the Athabascan hunting party led by Chief Sesui, who came to the rescue of some starving, nearly frozen U.S. Army explorers after a bear raided their cache in 1899. They took the men to their village, fed and clothed them for several months, and when the weather improved, guided them to safety. But it was the leader of that expedition, Lieutenant Joseph Heron, who was remembered with the name Heron Glacier, not Chief Sesui.
Every glacier has a story, and no two are alike.
That's why Clouda says when it comes to the indigenous history, the name of the glacier is literally the tip of the iceberg. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Cherokee Nation bike riders returned to the capital city of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma on Friday after finishing a 950-mile journey. This year's ride marked the Remember the Removal bike ride's 41-year anniversary. Riders followed the northern route of the Trail of Tears, honoring Cherokee ancestors who were forced to march it in the late 1830s. The journey began in Georgia and ended in Tahlequah. 12 cyclists from the Cherokee Nation took part in the ride over 3 weeks. Last week, U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. swore in Mark Cruz, a senior advisor to the Secretary for Indian Health. In a video on social media, Kennedy said the appointment is important for decision-making in the health department for Native Americans. Cruz is a citizen of the Klamath tribes. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com. Support by Arctic Encounter 2025 in Anchorage, Alaska. Convening voices from the Arctic and beyond with high-level panels, networking, the Far North Fashion Show, and more. Registration at arcticencounter.com. Support by Siri, with a diverse and strategic investment portfolio for the long-term benefit of their shareholders. Investing in energy, infrastructure, real estate, government services, and more. Information is available at CIRI.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. After her historic term as Interior Secretary, Deb Haaland is now looking to lead a state where one in every eight residents is Native American. Of course, she is one of those Native residents of New Mexico. If she wins the election a year from November, Haaland will be the third female New Mexico governor in a row and the first Native woman governor in the country. We will speak with Haaland this hour. But first, we want to learn more about an agreement to restore salmon in the Columbia River Basin, an agreement that was just rescinded by President Donald Trump. When it was first signed in 2023, the agreement put an end to decades of litigation over river resources. It dedicated $1 billion towards salmon restoration and renewable power projects. Ending that agreement puts tribes back to square one in efforts to restore salmon runs severely depleted by hydroelectric dams. You can join today's conversation by calling in at 1-800-996-2848. That number again, 1-800-996-2848, or just 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Toppenish, Washington, is Jeremy Takala. He's a member of the Yakama Nation Tribal Council and the chair of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. He is also Yakama. Jeremy, good morning, and welcome back to Native America Calling.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Also joining us today is Eric Holt. He is in Lapway, Idaho, where he's the chairman of the Nez Perce Tribal Fish and Wildlife Commission. He's also a Nez Perce tribal citizen. Eric, good morning to you as well, and welcome back to the show.
Hey, talk to me, my brother. Good to have you and good to hear you. Good to hear you.
Good to have you on the show as well, brother. And Jeremy, I want to begin with you. Let's first hear more about the initial agreement between the federal government and tribes in the Pacific Northwest. This memorandum of understanding was brokered in December of 2023. What exactly did the federal government promise to these tribes?
Yeah, well, thank you. Good morning, everyone. Again, Jeremy Takala here at the Yakama Nation. So, under this December 14th, 2023 Resilient Columbia Basin Agreement, that included the Yakima, Umatilla, Warm Springs, Nez Perce, and the states of Washington and Oregon, are collectively known as the Six Sovereigns. And this also had the NGO plaintiffs and the National Wildlife Federation, National Marine Fisheries Service, and also represented by Earth Justice. So under this agreement, the United States had made initial commitments in support of the Six Sovereigns Columbia Basin Restoration Initiative, including commitments for continued increased fisheries restoration funding, the development of fisheries restoration plans, negotiated interim hydro operations, studies analyzing how to provide continuity of services currently provided by the four lower Snake River dams, intended to ultimately facilitate conversations with Congress about dam breach. Updated environmental impact analysis, compliance documents for the Columbia River hydro systems, fish-friendly regional energy needs planning, and support for tribal energy sovereignty initiatives. So more importantly, this basically included like a $1 billion backlog Definitely needed infrastructure upgrades, habitat restoration, predation. The list goes on, but really trying to focus on the core piece of the Columbia River Basin work with the four tribes and the states of Oregon and Washington.
All right. Well, tell us more about what those initiatives could have done for the salmon, and specifically, what is the state of salmon runs in the Columbia River Basin?
Yeah, certainly. So, you know, historically, when our treaties were signed, you know, we had an abundance of salmon at 16 million plus to now on good years, close to 2 million. And so obviously this is a detriment to, you know, what was promised during our treaties, you know, to have that ability to fish, hunt, and gather at all usual custom areas. And this is important key when it comes to the treaties. And so a part of our work and the co-managed experiences to ensure that we have those fisheries available for each of our tribes, our different ceremonial homes, not only just to our tribes, but even to the Pacific Northwest and what it provides economically to the region, and also even the Alaska, Washington Coast, Oregon Coast fishery as well. So, you know, definitely we're not getting the benefit of our treaty bargain here. Culturally, economically, and ecological health for our region is important. And so I want to commend, you know, the hard work, sacrifices that each of our tribal leaders, the vision of our leaders, and also the support that we've received during this journey until up to where it was determined without any consultation, reaching out to the tribes of any sort.
Okay, and Jeremy, how far along did these initiatives get during that last year of the Biden administration? Was there any progress?
Certainly. So, yes, there was a few progress that was made. Of course, as we unfortunately, this termination has, taken place, we still want to ensure that we have those commitments for those each fiscal years of 24 and 25, where we had at least got two agencies, you know, ensure that those funded sources were out the door. We still need that, the support from each of those other agencies to commit for those last two fiscal years. However, you know, I want to mention that there was ongoing funding previously, but, we really were at the threshold, you know, to not see the improvement of funding sources to help initiate that ability to go more than just the extinction level. We wanted a vision to ensure that we had healthy and abundant levels of salmon that can benefit the whole entirety of the region.
All right. Now, Jeremy, the agreement also put a pause on lawsuits by the tribes. What happens now with those lawsuits going forward?
Well, it's really premature right now. The four tribes and the two states will have to obviously discuss our next steps, which, you know, we've begun those conversations. And quite honestly, you know, we were kind of, concerned as to if any action was going to take place during this administration. I will say that the acclimation and, you know, Columbia River Treaty tribes have, you know, a pretty good record when it comes to litigation and pursuit of our, you know, biological opinion, what the science has proven to ensure that we have appropriate spillage, appropriated funding sources to help see these, backlog of infrastructure or fish restorations, predation issues, all these sort of factors that have an impact to our fish runs to pursue the ability to fix these areas that are definitely needed.
Now, there was also a renewable energy push in the agreement, and that particularly benefited tribes. What is the status of that?
Yeah, certainly. So just like we want to ensure that those funding sources get out the door as well. I will speak for Yakima, you know, when it comes to the energy demand, which the tribes are very well aware of, we want to ensure that the energy build-out is going to be respective of tribal sovereignty, tribal cultural places, to ensure the energy build out in the region will not have a direct impact to our efforts to restore salmon, restore wildlife migratory routes, cultural properties, the different food gathering places that our people still continuously do today. What basically we want to ensure that we don't repeat the same history that we've seen on the Clem River with the displacement of our tribal folks, our burial grounds, different fishing sites. Of course, many of them remember Salila Falls, but also, you know, the detriment that it had on our salmon resources. So salmon, as well as our different roots, berries, the wild game, the medicines, they all go hand in hand. So we want to ensure that the energy build out will be respective of tribes. And so Yakima Nation has pursued two different energy projects that meet all of those check guidelines that will ensure this is appropriate energy. This, with every different energy, there's always a downfall. We can't call green energy green if it has an impact to tribal resources. So the tribes should be leading the effort, just as they are with the salmon. They need to be the leaders in the energy portion as well.
Jeremy, what are your other concerns right now going forward, and what can tribes do exactly without cooperation from the federal government?
Well, I think this is a moment in time where we have to reflect on the different administrations with our past tribal leaders, their ancestors, and to ensure that we pursue the accurate information. I want to ensure that our tribes and our states do continue outreach and education. We understand that the narrative that's being driven by the opposition are ensuring that the fish are doing fine. You know, we have 13 ESA listed stocks in the Columbia Basin. The condition is not getting any better. Sure, there's three of our stocks that have success stories that are doing a little better because of hatchery production and changes how we spill over dams for fish, but the work is unfinished. We still have a long road ahead of us to ensure that our salmon steelhead species are going to thrive for the generations to come. I want to ensure that, you know, our folks, you know, that we've never saw eye to eye with, like the fishing industry, the seafood industry, the sportsmen. We need to ensure that they understand the intent, the vision, the efforts that the tribes are pursuing. And so, you know, we want to gather again and ensure that we share the message, share the concerns.
All right, Jeremy, thank you for joining us. We're going to take a short break, and we will come back and continue this conversation. 1-800-99-NATIVE, the number to call to join. The White Earth Nation just opened Minnesota's first recreational cannabis business outside of tribal lands. The tribe plans on opening another soon in a state with a growing number of tribal cannabis operations. We'll look at lessons tribes are learning in the relatively new cannabis industry on the next Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Yo, hey, wahoo, ayo, nene.
You are listening to Native America Calling. We're hearing about threats to salmon in the Columbia River Basin and a turnaround by the federal government's promise to provide funds and other resources to reduce those threats. President Trump canceled a Biden-era agreement that tribes and conservation groups called historic. There's still plenty of time to add your comments about this move. Just call us at 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. We've got the phone lines open now, and we are waiting for your call. Let's talk now with Eric Holt. He's the chairman of the Nez Perce Tribal Fish and Wildlife Commission. He's in Lapway, Idaho. And Eric, we just heard Jeremy give us a really good overview of this memorandum of understanding that was reached back in 2023. And I want to ask you, how did the Nez Perce tribe benefit from the agreement during the time that it was in place?
I think there's a lot of areas that we benefited from. One was, I think, the most important was collaboration. I think that, one, we had the four tribes and the two states that were in collaboration and unity, if you will, and standing in solidarity with the commitment to protect salmon from extinction. And so for that, you know, I think that was the most important part of it. And, you know, and at the same time, you know, knowing that we're at the semi-quasi-extinction level, as Jeremy spoke to, that, you know, we have 13 stocks in peril, and this agreement was helping to ensure that we were doing the right thing to be the voice for the salmon. And with this agreement, you know, in place, it helped that unification of the voice going forward. And, you know, it made all of us come to the table with an understanding that what we were doing was for the betterment of the whole Pacific Northwest region, and not just one tribe in particular, or even the tribes at all. It's, you know, our treaties and what we're doing and the process that we were engaged with and the time and effort and sacrifices that the tribe and the past leaders have given to this cause, you know, shows that, you know, we were committed to this and we still are, you know, and you know, we know that, you know, even though the executive order is to stop the agreement, you know, we still have that within us to continue to be that strong voice and stand with the other tribes and the other entities that were willing to, you know, to be that for the voice of the salmon. And going forward, we need that collaboration, because I think that was the most important part of this agreement, was the unity of it going forward. And now that we, you know, have this roadblock, if you will, you know, we have to show our resolve and come together again, and, you know, and to convince and to make those people understand on those different party lines, whether they're Republican or Democrat, you know, to understand the importance that, you know, what we're doing is not just for our purpose, it's for the betterment of all. And I think that's what the that initiative was doing. I mean, it brought people to the table, and, you know, as Jeremy stated, you know, we had all of the different parts of the industry that were going to be affected or impacted, and it's not just one component or another. We're trying to understand that there's going to be, you know, needs to be, all these different components need to be addressed in a manner that everybody, you know, and some of the things, you know, there has to be some compromise. And I think that's what that initiative was doing, was bringing those people and parties and entities to the table to get an understanding of what the impacts are and what we can do to rectify them going forward. And so, you know, with this initiative, I just feel like, you know, we need to, go, but, you know, it's not going back to the drawing board, because we've already committed so much work and time into this that, you know, we just need to relook at how things are going to affect us, and then make the most strategic approach going forward, and have that in a unified voice going forward as well.
Eric, how long were the tribes working to get that agreement in place?
Well, I know the Nez Perce tribe, I'm speaking with our chairman, you know, we had committed, the Nez Perce tribe back in the early 2000s was trying to get something like this going. And I know it happened again in 2015 and 2018. So it's been a long commitment by the Nez Perce tribe. And I know the other tribes have the same purpose and understanding as well. But, you know, we knew that there was some things happening on the horizon, and the Nez Perce tribe was wanting to bring this initiative in a way that would focus on, you know, collaboration and unity, and then an understanding that the Snake River dams were the big cause of, you know, what was happening to the, not only the diminishment of the run, but, you know, habitat loss and the estuary, you know, damages that's being caused by the cesspools of the dams that are created by the slack water, the predator fish, you know, all those things combined. And then industry and recreation forcing the issue as well, is that, you know, the demands for recreation and industry has increased tenfold. So we have a lot of things going against us when it comes to that. So we have to have that collaboration and understanding that there's, you know, more important things out there than just, you know, recreation and in the interest of industry. You know, we need this, we can't see the salmon go extinct in our lifetime. And I, you know, I say that with a hurtful heart today, because, you know, we're battling this uphill fight, you know, and it seems that, you know, every time, you know, the uncertainty of the Trump administration has certainly added to this, you know, in a way that, you know, fuel to the fire, in more ways than, you know, I think any of the tribes have anticipated. But yet I know our tribes have been looking at it, you know, in a lot of different ways, in looking at the impacts. You know, everybody across the nation has felt it in one way or the other. And even the non-Indian, you know, those people are starting to feel the impacts of what Trump has done through his DOGE efforts and dismantling of the federal agencies that were partnership with the four tribes and the states in collaboration. And so when that went away, you know, it just halted a big process and effort. And then one, you know, a lot of people in those other agencies that are, you know, that have, you know, faced elimination or firing or early retirement never got to see their work fulfilled and then fill that emptiness and that void of being cut off before the end result was here. And, you know, we may not have seen the end result in our lifetime, but at least their time and sacrifice, something that they could, you know, look back on and be satisfied that they helped salmon in one way or the other.
Sure. Eric, the president has also signaled a renewed support for dams like those on the Columbia and Snake Rivers. Other than delaying any progress for restoring salmon, will this new direction have any long-term effects on conservation and the future of salmon recovery?
Oh, yes. It's something that will continue to be the voice for bringing the Snake River dams down. Now, we know that they've had a far greater impact than any other. The impact out there don't come close to what the dams have done over time. And people see the, you know, the runs come back, and they see the last couple of years where the runs have came back a little bit higher or bigger than the preseason forecast. Well, these preseason forecasts haven't even been at a number that is really satisfiable to the tribe, because, you know, when we do our ceremonial permits per se in the springtime, you know, we don't even get enough to give one fish per tribal member. So that goes to show you that we're still in conservation mode, because we collaborate as the four tribes, and we make it so that we understand the importance of not over-impacting the run as they come in, year out. And so we have to adjust for that as well. So, you know, when we see the ceremonial needs go unmet because of the resources not there, you know, each and every year it's a different management obligation that we have to have to our people, but first for the salmon. And so when we see those numbers dwindle down due to, and which we say in large part to the dams, you know, and we knew that there's opposition and great opposition, because we have a lot of people that depend on the, you know, the barges and the dams themselves. But, you know, we see that there's a lot of things that could, you know, we can eliminate if the dams go away. We have a lot of things that have already been in place that are talking of collaboration in terms of, like we were speaking to, the farming industry, you know, recreation, all those different things. It's not something, it's a part of the whole agreement that all the four tribes in the states were a part of. And so, you know, then dams, you know, the Nez Perce tribe has been at the forefront of wanting to remove them, and we still will be that voice for that going forward.
And Eric, you mentioned the Nez Perce tribe does have resources, it does have expertise, it has a lot of commitment. What more can you folks do to protect salmon populations from here on out, just the tribe working on its own?
Well, for one, I know that, you know, the actions that, you know, it tries to hide from the truth. And the truth is that, you know, the Nez Perce tribe holds the duty to speak for the salmon on behalf of the salmon. And the truth is that extinction of salmon populations is happening now. and people across the Northwest know this. People across the nation have supported us in a vision for preventing salmon extinction, and that would be, at the same time, create a stronger and better future for the Northwest. And I believe it's a shared vision by the states of Washington, Oregon, you know, the four tribes, the Yakima, Umatilla, Warm Springs, and Nez Perce, under this initiative. And our vision is still that, you know, we believe it was supported publicly and privately by most people in the Northwest. So I believe it's a vision underlaid by the treaties of our Northwest tribes and by the United States Constitution that protects those treaties, and by the federal statutes enacted by Congress to protect salmon and other species from extinction. So I think there's a lot of, you know, we have things that are in place that, you know, one, it, you know, takes an act of Congress for a lot of these things, but at the same time, you know, our treaties are the baseline for these protections, and for the government to understand that they have a federal trust responsibility to the four tribes, and that's at the forefront, you know, along with the Constitution of the United States. You know, the treaties are the supreme law of the land, and those are contracts. So those, the government mm-hmm. knows that they're in a contract with each of the tribes, and they have to understand it from that standpoint.
Well, Eric, tell me more about what you're hearing from families there within the Nez Perce tribe. I've been along the Columbia River there. I've seen the scaffolds where many of your families fish. I know how vitally important it is to the culture there among the Nez Perce people. What are they saying, and what are their biggest concerns?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that question up. I just got a phone call this morning from one of our tribal elder women. That's, you know, she's a head cook for a lot of our ceremonies and things, and she was just her, you know, her first initial thought was, you know, I'm the Nez Perce. We have a our NEPTIC, our tribal council, is holding its first tribal executive council meeting over in the Wallowa Valley over in Joseph, Oregon tomorrow, which is historic. It's the first time the Nez Perce is coming home to the Wallowas, you know, since the 1877 war. And so when she was talking to me about that, she said that she's really worried about the Trump administration and what's out there in the future for us. And she just thought that, you know, our commission needs to you know, start thinking about, you know, getting things in order for our first foods, you know, and protecting them and doing what we can for the first foods, first and foremost. And, you know, so we're just, and she just wanted to talk to me about tomorrow's meeting and that she was going over to represent her family and her people. And, you know, we're really excited for this opportunity to go over there and, one, renew our connection to the Wallowa area, you know, to the, that's where, you know, I'm a direct descendant of Chief Joseph, so going over there is, you know, something I think is beneficial for our people, a renewal of our spirit, you know, our connection to the land, and to let them know that we're still here. And so I think that's the most important part of the message that we can get is that, you know, our families are worried, you know, and rightfully so, but they're still out there engaging in fishing and berry picking and root gathering. So they know that the necessity is needed still to go out there and do what they do to gather and pick these first foods and gather them, because the uncertainty of the future is there as well, and they understand that. So hearing it from them and understanding that gives me a, you know, a sense that I need to, you know, one, do my part and to understand what are the things that are on the horizon from the government side and, you know, the politics issues of it, and then bring that forward to the people and get the, you know, so they understand it as well, because they know that there's with Trump and what we've seen already, there's a lot of things that can go awry, and I think that we've already seen that. And he has a disregard for indigenous people, you know, on all fronts. And so we need to be mindful of that. And so I really appreciate the question, because I think it's important that our people, and we hear our people's voices and bring that forward as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely, brother. And appreciate you and Jeremy coming on the show today to update us and keep us posted, okay? Keep us in the loop and let us know how this all evolves.
Sounds good. Appreciate you guys. Thanks for having me.
You bet. You bet. Phone number is 1-800-996-2848 for anyone who would like to join today's conversation. And I'm going to go ahead and pivot now, and we're going to bring a new guest into the conversation who joins us on Zoom, Deb Holland, former United States Secretary of the Interior. She's also a former member of Congress from the state of New Mexico. She is Laguna Pueblo from the village of Mesita. Gwatsi Sehoba, Secretary Holland, and welcome back to Native America Calling. It's a pleasure.
Dawa F, thank you, Sean. It's nice to see you and hear from you again. I hope you're well.
I'm doing well. Yeah, thank you for asking. Well, geez, I've been on this show now for a few years, and I finally had the chance to interview you, so I'm excited. And I mean, I don't know where to begin, but let's just talk about all of the firsts in your career. You were the first woman elected to the Laguna Development Corporation Board of Directors, and for folks that don't know, that's the for-profit entity of the Pueblo of Laguna that manages business and economic development interests. You were also the first Native woman to head the New Mexico Democratic Party. And along with Sharice Davids, you were the first Native woman elected to Congress and then the first Native woman cabinet secretary. Tell us more. How did your sense of responsibility evolve as you reached those various positions and milestones during your career?
Absolutely. Thank you for the question. So, sometimes it's you just step up, right? You see a need and you feel that sometimes it's your duty to step up. And so I just stepped up, I stepped up to run for the chair position. I was chosen by my tribe to be on the board of directors of Laguna Development, and I stepped up to run for chair of the board of that entity. And then, of course, when the seat became vacant for Congressional District 1, I just felt that we had never had a Native woman in Congress, and it was about time. It's just, I guess my dad's a 30-year career Marine. My mom was in the Navy. Both my parents were public servants. My mom ended up serving for 25 years in the BIA. You just step up when you're needed. And so that's been kind of my philosophy. If somebody needs me, then I try to be there. And that's the reason I'm stepping up again here in New Mexico to run for governor in 2026.
I was going to say, not only do you step up, but you step up quickly, because you announced your bid for New Mexico governor as soon as your Biden administration post ended. Have you even had time to think really about your legacy as Interior Secretary?
Well, my legacy is put to the test every single day with this Trump administration. And of course, the Columbia River issue. It's a devastating one that he's made a really ridiculous and non-thinking decision by this administration. I think about the things that we were able to accomplish in the Department of the Interior throughout the last administration, and so proud of the work that me and my team did. And to see some of these things just undone with the swipe of a pen, it's really, it's sad, it's disgraceful, it's devastating. And I hope that people, rightly so, raise their voices, protest, file lawsuits, all of the above, because that's what needs to happen in this current, the current chaos of this administration.
All right, Secretary Holland, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and continue our conversation. And for anyone who would like to ask a question, give us a call, 1-800-99-NATIVE.
Global business executives, top government officials, diplomats, and indigenous leaders will attend Arctic Encounter 2025, North America's premier Arctic policy and business event. From July 30th to August 1st in Anchorage, Alaska, this international summit convenes voices from across the Arctic and beyond to shape policy, investment, and innovation in the far north. Arctic Encounter is where global decisions meet northern realities. Registration for this global dialogue at arcticencounter.com, who support this show. Did you know that one person can save up to 8 lives and heal dozens more through the gift of organ and tissue donation? Give hope to thousands of people across the U.S. waiting for a life-saving organ transplant. Learn more about the power of organ, eye, and tissue donation with Life Center Northwest, the organ procurement organization serving all of Alaska, at lcnw.org. That's lcnw.org.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's AMERIND.com.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support by Costco Business Center, offering delivery to Anchorage Air Cargo Companies for shipments to rural Alaska, for business and home. More at CostcoBusinessDelivery.com.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce, and we're talking with former Interior Secretary Deb Haaland. She's a leading voice for Native people on an international scale and has broken barriers throughout her business and political career. If you have a comment or a question, you can call us. You can join the conversation, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And Secretary Haaland, before the break, I asked you a little bit about just how you think of and how you reflect on your time there as Interior Secretary. And of course, you were celebrated for all the work you did for healing with regard to Indian boarding schools. You raised awareness for missing and murdered Indigenous relatives. Is there any one goal that you set out to accomplish that you wish you'd had more time to achieve, though? I'm curious.
Well, of course, you can always achieve more, right? And when I first got there, 4 years seemed like such a long time, but yet in the last few days of our administration, tribes were calling and, you know, we want to get this across the finish line. There's always more you can do. And so I try not to lament that too much, right? I really want to just concentrate on the things that we were able to get across the finish line. And, you know, the tribally led conservation efforts that we were a part of, those were so rewarding. And I think about those opportunities often. And so really grateful that we had wonderful partners in the administration doing that conservation work.
What was your initial reaction when you saw just the abrupt changes there with the new administration, attacks on diversity and equity initiatives? Also, some of the staffing cuts right there within your Department of Interior. What was your thought in going forward? What do you think is going to be the long-term impact?
Right. So just when I think about the team I had at the Interior Department, a workforce of nearly 70,000 career employees, several hundred appointees, senior leadership working to manage, you know, all of those folks, and just traveling across the country, getting opportunities to see the work of the career staff, you know, at the U.S. Geological Survey, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on our national wildlife refuges, national parks. Every job was important. Every single job in that department is important. Everybody does really important work. And with climate change looming and affecting our everyday lives, even right now, those jobs become even more important. So, of course, the first thing I thought of when they're, and this is the thing, they were cutting jobs before they even knew what those people did. They didn't look at titles. They just said, we're slashing and burning these jobs, these programs, this funding. And I just believe it's going to have a devastating impact. We're you know, in the middle of summer right now. I'm sure there are so many national parks and other public lands, our wildlife refuges that just don't have the capacity to deal with all of the visitation that they get, because as you likely know, visitation went up exponentially during COVID, when people realized how important our outdoors are to our well-being as mm-hmm. As Americans. And so, yes, it's terrible, it's sad, it's devastating, it's very short-sighted. It is not the way to run a country.
Many critics of the president right now are also critical of the Democrats in Congress for not doing enough to slow down what's seen as an unprecedented pace of change within the federal government. As a former Democratic member of Congress yourself, what more do you wish the opposing party would do to slow down Trump or block him in some of these initiatives?
Well, I'll say that, you know, Democrat or Republican, the Republicans are all in, you know, they have the majorities now. When I got sworn into Congress, the Democrats, you know, we won back the majority. And so it's different when you're in the majority, right? You're the one who calls hearings and you bring bills to the floor. And you, I mean, these are things that you can do in the majority. And when you're in the minority, it's difficult to get a lot done. So, but so I really feel, Sean, that it's falling on the American people to stand up for the things they know. This administration is devastating, right? They're devastating our country in so many ways, and it's up to us to stand up and do whatever we can to stop that. And it's one of the reasons why I'm running for office, because I want to make sure that we can win back at least the majority in the House. I believe that's very doable. So I'm going to do everything in my power here in New Mexico to make sure that I'm supporting our Democratic candidates, our Democratic House candidates here in New Mexico, because we absolutely need to be in a place where we can make decisions, where we have the power to call hearings and, you know, move bills through legislature, and then of course stop the worst things that this president is doing to our country.
Well, let's talk more about the upcoming midterm election. It'll be here, obviously, before we know it, just a year away. And President Trump, he does enjoy a 46% approval rating. How do you see this playing out next year, and where do you see both houses of Congress ending up there after November 2026?
Yes, well, I believe very strongly that we can win back the House, and there the House will be able to stop the worst things that this president is trying to move through. Right now, there's a bill in the Senate that would devastate Medicaid, right? Nearly half of our population in New Mexico is Medicaid eligible. What happens when they destroy Medicaid? You know, what happens when they continue to defund programs and fire people from the Veterans Administration so that our veterans don't have access to health care? These are all things that are terrible. And not to mention the Indian Health Service, right, which is also dependent on Medicaid. So, you know, governors will be the first line of defense against the most horrible cuts and you know, horrible things that are happening to communities in our states, and I will step up in any way I possibly can if I'm the next governor of New Mexico.
And if that happens, you will become the first Native woman governor of any state. Tell us more about what a Native woman can bring there to the state capital in Santa Fe.
Right. Well, representation matters, right? And I say that often. But I didn't realize how much it mattered until I actually, you know, won my first election to Congress, and Congresswoman Davids and I were able to bring, you know, highlight big important issues like missing and murdered Indigenous people, right? That's where I started my work on the boarding schools, was when I was a member of Congress. People don't know what they don't know. And so if you have a different perspective than the majority of folks who were in a, you know, a certain body, then you have the opportunity to bring your perspective to light. And, you know, one thing that that I used to tell young folks when they'd come into my office, whether it was in Congress or at the Department of the Interior, is I would say, you know, never forget where you came from. And I would say that I never realized that the times I spent with my grandfather in his cornfield would inspire or inform a public service career that I have come to have, but it has, right? Those experiences that I have as a Pueblo kid and now, you know, having advocated for tribes and working with tribes and you know, I was a tribal administrator at one time. I mean, all of these things have informed the work that I've done, and I think it's important work because underrepresented communities deserve a seat at the table. And I'll also say that, you know, just when I look around New Mexico, there's a lot of people struggling, right? They don't make enough money. Parents have to work 2 or 3 jobs to make ends meet. I also understand what that's like. I know what it's like to not be able to pay rent and buy groceries in the same month. And it makes me understand how important SNAP benefits are. And if those get cut, people like me, they go hungry. It's just that's the sad fact of things. And so, yes, though, I think it's, you know, it's perspectives from everything that I have experienced, but certainly, you know, helping our country maybe to understand our history a little bit more, I think will also be helpful.
I'm glad you mentioned the work you've done with tribal governments, because I'm curious to know how you've been able to use your influence to advocate for Native women who might also want to pursue elected leadership positions in tribal governments. And I'm thinking especially within our own tribal nation, the Pueblo of Laguna.
Of course. Well, sometimes I joke that it was easier for me to run, you know, raise $1 million and run for Congress than it was to run for a seat on the tribal council at Laguna. But in a way, that's kind of true. I recognize that, I'll just say that leadership is important. And running, you know, running even outside your tribal community, running for school board, running for city council or county commission, or a state legislator position, these are all important ways that tribal folks can have an impact on their communities. And so it is absolutely important. I have worked really hard to mentor a lot of Native women, and some of those women have actually won their elections and are serving in our state legislature now, so I'm very proud of that. But I feel that, you know, if you see someone, you know, break a glass ceiling, as they say, you might think, oh, it'll be easier for me now to do it, right? So I always say that I want to leave the ladder down for other folks to climb up. And certainly, you know, women are still a minority everywhere. In government, in elected position, in CEO jobs, you name it, women are still minorities in so many of these areas. So I just want more women to step up and have the courage to run.
Secretary Holland, I'll ask you about immigration, because that's an issue that's very, very closely watched there in New Mexico. Especially undocumented immigration. And the president's aggressive anti-immigration stance is supported by a large percentage of Americans. So what is the balance there in New Mexico? Because obviously you need to protect the border with Mexico. You need to provide public safety while also accommodating those who may be undocumented but have a role in American society. How do you find that balance?
Of course. Well, first of all, I'll say that you know, early on when this president came into office and started his aggression toward immigrant communities, you know, we read that federal law enforcement officers were questioning Native Americans about their citizenship. And that, it, you know, that puts up a red flag for me. Quite frankly, every single human being deserves to be treated with dignity and respect. And that is something that definitely needs to happen. And I'll say that we learned this from the first Trump administration, that, you know, their work at separating families has been devastating to those families. That's what the federal government did with Native American communities through history. They separated us from our families. They separated the children from the parents and the community so they could have better control over those people, so they could try and manipulate our communities into bending to the will of the federal government. And we see how that turned out. They failed at it, thankfully. Tribes were a lot stronger than the federal government ever anticipated. But I think that there's a big difference between a safe border and taking parents away from their children or children away from their parents. I think that we can have safe borders and we can also keep families together. Here in New Mexico, I know that we care about all of our communities, and I just will say that if I'm governor of the state of New Mexico, I couldn't do Trump's bidding. The way they're handling their immigration, by sending Marines into places and instilling fear in all, the citizenships of these communities, it's really a sad state of affairs.
And in addition to all of these goals and all these ambitions, what else excites you about coming home to New Mexico, besides, of course, the really good chili and all the other great food we have?
Oh, God. Well, thanks for mentioning the food. That's always a highlight everywhere I go. yes. Well, I mean, look, they don't call it the land of enchantment for nothing, right? I've taken a few road trips since I've been, since I've launched my campaign. And we just have the most beautiful landscapes, the most beautiful sunsets. I was driving home from Santa Fe the other night, and the sunset was, I almost stopped on the side of the road so I could take a photo. But then I thought, photographs don't do it justice. It's something you have to experience in person. It's just so beautiful here. And I know that we have, we have some fires that are happening right now across our state. And so my prayers are with our firefighters. They're the heroes of our time during this time of climate change. And so I just feel like we need to care so much about our landscapes, and I do, and I will as governor. So I'm excited every time I walk out my door and I see the Sandia Mountains there. Sometimes the moon is coming up behind the mountains, and it's just an amazing sight, and I'm just really grateful to be a New Mexican.
Secretary Holland, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. I'm thinking maybe the next time I'll see you will be at Laguna Feast on September 19th, so I'll keep an eye out, okay?
You bet. I'll look for you too, Sean.
All right. Thank you so much. And with that, unfortunately, we're out of time. So I want to say thanks to all of our guests who joined us today, Secretary Deb Holland, Jeremy Takala, and also Eric Holt. And please, listeners, join us again tomorrow when we will talk about breakthroughs and challenges for tribes getting into the cannabis business. Until then, I'm your host, Sean Spruce. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Yat-e. Guys, don't wait until you have symptoms. Regular checkups may catch health issues early, and conditions like diabetes, heart disease, liver disease, and prostate cancer are more treatable when caught early. Ask your Indian health care provider what health checks are recommended for your age and lifestyle. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Challenges to societal harmony abound. Trauma, depression, addiction. In Native communities, these challenges affect nearly everyone. The Native American Social Work Studies Institute educates social workers for careers to address the needs of Native communities. You can be part of the solution as a peer support worker, community health worker, or a counselor with culturally relevant training from the Native American Social Work Studies Institute. Info at online.nmhu.edu. New Mexico Highlands University supports this show.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite.